This is the After Hours Director's Spotlight, presented by Amro Music. It's the podcast where we chat with music educators to celebrate the joy of teaching music and learn about strategies for success. This week, Nick Averwater continues his conversation with Jared Cassidy, K-12 Performing Arts Coordinator for Lexington Public Schools in Lexington, Massachusetts, a town of around 35,000 people located 10 miles northwest of Boston. Jared is the 2015 recipient of the Grammy Award in Music Education, and in 2022, he was one of 30 teachers who received the CMA Foundation's Music Teacher of Excellence Award. He's in his 20th year as a music educator. This week's episode picks up in the middle of a wide-ranging conversation about incorporating DEI into a music curriculum and seeing how it leads to better musical experiences for students and better prepares them for life after high school. If you haven't heard the previous program, which posted on January 27, 2023, we recommend that you listen to that first to give proper context to this episode. Our conversation was recorded December 13th, 2022.
Jared, I want to dig in a little even deeper on this topic, right? Because I know we're going to have a listener listening to this, and they said, Jared, this all sounds good. But, you know, you're from Massachusetts, right? And you're in a diverse community. And so it's really easy to talk about diversity when it's a diverse community. So what advice would you give an educator who is either in one of two circumstances? Number one, they're in a school district where DEI is not really something that's prioritized at the administrative level, not a conversation that's being had. Or number two, perhaps they haven't talked about it in the past. They're standing at the starting line, and they just don't really know how to start this conversation in their program. What advice would you give them, Jared?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, especially because I'm a person from so many different identities myself. So people are like, oh, you have like an in, it's so easy. I'm like, it's not easy. It's definitely not easy. It's actually sometimes harder for me to have those conversations. Honestly, I think that, the Northeast where I am, not only just my district, but like this whole area for the most part is very, very, is a little bit more open to having these conversations. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we hear now. I'm part of a lot of committees for NAFME and things like that. We hear so much feedback from other parts of the country and how to handle this. I think at the end of the day, first of all, one needs to frame in their heads, why is this work important to me to begin with? Okay. They want to have these conversations. Okay. Why? So if you are in another part of the country that might not be where this focus on DEI is emphasized, or, you know, you're not really, you haven't started the work yourself. The question is, well, why do you want to start the work here first? Like, why do you think the work is important to you? Okay. Because without your own why, it's going to be really hard to kind of like make the work that authentic and connected and genuine. Okay. I also open up the conversation with students and also colleagues about like, why do they think this work is important, or why do they not think this work is important? And sometimes that reinforces why we need to be doing what we're doing. I don't work in a bubble either. Even here where we have such a really great support for having these conversations, I still work with our director of student services. I still work with it's called a METCO program. We have students from Boston area that come out and they are bused into Lexington for public school education or whatnot. So I talk a lot with city school teachers and administrators. I talk with a number of, we have a lot of affinity groups in our area, things like that. And even if your community does not have such resources as that, I think like connecting with other folks nationally is a huge, huge aspect. Taking professional development and workshops, having direct conversations with your administration, with community members. I think it's a matter of the dialogue. And I do understand, I do recognize also that there are teachers in all parts of the country, and there's parts of the country that are handling this in their own unique ways. But again, I think it's about really living outside of the sphere of you just doing this work. Well, you are doing the work, but like, why is it important to you? What does your community and community and school district value? And then on top of that, how can you see things from a broader perspective and gain more insights from people in other similar and also dissimilar working environments? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I love the start with why question. I mean, have you read that book, Start With Why?
Well, of course, yeah.
I can tell just the way. I mean, it has brought – it's one of my favorites. I highly encourage it to our listeners, the book Start With Why. But I can tell just how that question influences so much of what you do, because it's such an important question. So, Jared, what's at stake? I mean, if we don't do this, right? Mm-hmm. So what's at stake from the students' experience?
What's at stake is that we're going to be creating and perpetualizing not even students, but human beings that are going to enter the workforce, regardless if it's music or not, handling some of the challenges that we are looking at as a nation, as a society, geopolitically, you know, as well as the collaborative and creative aspects of where we're going with science and technology, with medicine. We're inhibiting that if we're not providing an opportunity for students to really be creative. You know, think about the four C's of creativity and connection and you know, cultivating those kind of skills. It's even more important now these days because the world is shifting. The landscape of education is also shifting. So for us as educators, especially music educators, our relevance and our impact is going to be seen through a different light. I work with a lot of teachers, not just here in my district. I've worked in workshops and I've been given talks and things like that to folks that are so tied to what music education should be. You know, we teach how we were taught, Nick. And I think that sometimes it's hard to let go of that tangible philosophical understanding. If we're not able to flex and reimagine and really rest in the discomfort of having some of these challenging discussions ourselves, it's going to impact the longitudinal sustainability of our profession. And also, it's going to limit the kind of experiences and broad range goals that our students could have. Look at music education right now. You know, is it yes, still having ensembles is important, but what kind of ensembles? What about music industry in public school education? What about the interconnected, interdisciplinary aspects of music with science and social studies and English? You know, what are those ways that we can reimagine our curriculum in a way that flexes with where public school education, private school education is moving in? We can't stop that shift right now. So we have to find a way to really, really, this is our in, having these conversations, involving our students, and looking at things from an access and equity standpoint, it's a really important conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the clarity you brought to that. Do these things, talking about these things, incorporating them into the curriculum the way that you have, does it make students more empathetic, do you think?
I agree. And it needs to be done. I feel it needs to be done so in an authentic way. There's a lot of administrators I've talked with across the nation and also like where I am now where, you know, let's incorporate a DEI curriculum. Let's incorporate this experience. We're doing this. The thing is like DEI, social emotional learning, you don't do that to students. We don't do that to each other. It's embedded within our practice. And so I think that for us, we've got to get away from this notion of like just adding this extra experience in, scheduling time for it, this and that. That's like not even a Band-Aid. That's just like checking off a box. We need to be really committed beyond like really, really deeply rooted in order for us to make these systemic changes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I just think that's something that's becoming more and more important. And I'm not meaning to step onto a soapbox and everything like that. I think students learning empathy. I think we learn so much is so important. The ability to listen to each other and to appreciate their past, somebody's past and the experiences that they've been through changes a lot of perspectives about how we think and feel about people, even perhaps people we don't always agree with. I think that's really important.
Going back to like our ensemble rehearsal dedications, that's a perfect example of like storytelling. It seems like such a simple thing. Oh, back in elementary school, we did a lot of storytelling. Storytelling from experience and lived experience, that has amazing, amazing impact. I think that we cannot underscore that or undermine that.
Yeah. So Jared, we've talked about what's at stake. We've talked about how to start the journey. You mentioned that you work with a lot of other educators as part of this conversation. How can we do this wrong, right? Like what are some of the gutters of DEI that we need your help staying out of if we're also just starting this journey?
Well, one of them I already talked about is like the whole ally cookie thing, just like checking off boxes. Oh, I did this. Yeah, I'm doing diverse repertoire. You have to be really, really intentional. So I think that's one thing. The other aspect is, again, you have to really understand where you are within your own implicit and explicit bias. You got to really unpack where you are and be honest with yourselves. And that's a really hard thing to do. And it's a thing that I think it's an aspect of this work that I think folks are the most uncomfortable because I think people don't want to be seen as bad people. And I don't think people are bad people. I'm actually one of those people that think everybody's really a good person. and also taking the time to really recognize and live in that kind of discomfort. So I think those folks that are like, oh yeah, I did this, and I acknowledge that, and saying, oh, I'm not racist, I'm not. It's not a matter of like if you are or you're not. It's about how we respond and how we work to do better. You know, Maya Angelou's like quote again, like we want to do better again tomorrow. We learn and we want to do better. So I think that's the second thing. If I had to say something else, I think it goes back to when you just think of DEI, you have a mindset that DEI and social emotional learning is just something that you're doing. You've got a plan for it and it's not embedded within your practice. That's a downfall too. I feel like sometimes that we compartmentalize, unfortunately, what are becoming buzzwords around DEI and access and SEL to our actual mindset. You know, it's amazing to see the shifts change though. I have teachers I work with that like, oh, you know, Jared, I realize that the resources that I'm displaying in my PowerPoint for my kids when we're going over this folk song, I could be using these other resources that represent and show pictures of like students of people that look like my students. I'm like, yeah, it's like those small shifts and things like that are huge, you know? So I think that some folks get really scared that like I think the fourth thing I would say is we're just not going to have the conversation. I'm too scared. I'm too nervous. I'm afraid I'm going to offend someone and I'm just going to shut down. I'm just going to keep my head down and do my thing and not talk about anything that could get me into trouble. I don't think that's the way to go either. I think that we're at a point where, you know, the more work we do with this, the more challenging the conversations will be, you know, and that's a good thing. It's hard, but it's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for your clarity on this. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, your experiences. I think this is just an awesome topic and you've done a great job articulating it. So Jared, I would love to hear your thoughts. I mean, we've touched on some really good things. And just to kind of bring all this together, how do you define success for yourself as an administrator? And how do you define success for yourself as an educator of your wind ensemble?
I think they're one and the same. Even though I'm an administrator, I'm still working to support and coach teachers and to support our community, which involves our students, of course. As a teacher, I'm looking to support the context of the organization I work with, which is the Wind Ensemble. Oh, man. To bring it all home, my understanding of success is that I'm constantly being reflective. I'm constantly questioning in a good way. Reconsidering, listening, I think is a big thing. And Nick, you said that a couple times today. It sounds like I'm a fast-paced person because I talk fast. I tend to be pretty reflective, and I try to listen and hear things from as many perspectives as possible to inform programmatic decisions, to inform the repertoire I'm going to do with my students, to inform the way I present myself in front of my students as a model and exemplar of what I hope that they'll take with them to wherever they go once they graduate Lexington High School. I think listening is something that's been completely, sometimes, especially in this technological world, shoved aside sometimes. We're all ready to say something. We're all ready to respond. But taking the time to really listen, and listen actively, and listen with empathy. I love that you said empathy earlier too. To be like, you know what? Yeah, this is a really, really difficult conversation. These views that this person's talking about might not be the same as mine. But what happened in their life experience, or what informs their own experience today that makes them think in that way? You know, I have that conversation with my husband all the time. It's called a relationship. You know, like what are you doing? Like what are you doing? You know, and I think that's helped to helped me to evolve as well. You know, I think that placing ourselves in situations where our points of views might not be the dominant point of view is an important aspect as well, taking that risk. I think that success is really, it's really not an ending. It's just really, really moving in that direction that like, it's going to keep you uncomfortable in a way that's going to help others and yourself grow.
That makes yeah. sense. Yeah. This is just so important because you're right. I think the easy button now, the default setting is when we want to quote unquote have these conversations, we snap on our caps lock and kind of shout at each other on social media, but that really doesn't teach us anything. And I think something that can't be missed now is where else can these conversations be had, right? I mean, and this is not to throw shade at the math teachers or the science teachers or anything like that. These conversations, though, probably are not occurring in those subjects. If they are, great for those teachers, and I applaud them and thank you. But just the topic itself doesn't naturally lend itself for these conversations to take place. Music, it does, right? So if these conversations aren't happening in music, they might not be happening at all for that student, right? And I just think, gosh, it's just so important, and the clarity you've brought has been so great.
And I think that's one thing, like I was saying, live outside your bubble in the sense of, like, connect with other teachers that are in other disciplines. You know, I am fortunate to work in a district where they are having those conversations in our math and our science classes. They are having these kind of conversations in elementary school and middle school. They're having them in all, you know, all aspects. And I could imagine the challenge it would be. You said something that was really, really interesting right there, is that, like, if the conversation is not happening in music, where is it happening for these kids? It's a good point. That's a really, really, really good point. Like, we have the opportunity to really, really provide a perspective and a space for our students to really wrestle with these important topics. It's a really good point. Yeah.
So Jared, if a student that graduated from your program 10 years ago walked up to you and said, Mr. Cassidy, you taught me blank, what could be the most impactful words that were in that blank that you feel like you taught those students?
Man, that's a really good question. I would say you taught me how to love. How to love? That sounds kind of weird. Like, you know, I would say to open that up, it's not just the love, but like to be, like we're saying, be empathetic. To find love of something, whether it be within the context of music, to translate these same, what I call life lessons, to other aspects of my life. And it's not just your vocation. Education, like as you go through school, is not just about math classes and AP classes and even wind ensemble. It's really developing the capacity to develop social skills to enable you to connect with other people. And so I love when students come back and they're like, yeah, I feel like I was able to handle a challenge that was handed to me from a social standpoint. You know what I mean? Or a conflict. Or you gave me kind of an insight into how to navigate a challenging conversation, you know. It's those kind of things. Those are life skills, you know. And we have challenging conversations in music all the time. We could even be talking about, like, the phrasing or the articulation, and it's all up for, you know, interpretation. It's that same thing, you know. Music is like that. It translates into such a direct mirror and reflection of, like, the world we live in, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I just love this conversation so much. So, well, Jared, we've talked about how you define success, and as we're at 50 minutes, which is hard to believe, the time has absolutely flown by. I'm having a ball. But I would love you mentioned something. We unpacked it, and I just want to circle back and not let this opportunity slip by. We mentioned culture, right? We mentioned the evolution of your culture, and I would love to hear how you define culture and how that definition has evolved over the years, and we'll talk about how you teach it or how you plan for it.
Yeah, culture is felt, like, as an administrator that has to supervise and evaluate teachers, I go into classrooms, you can feel it right when you walk in that classroom, what the feeling is, the overarching, like, tone, that like indescribable feeling. You can feel it if, you know, some days, like our ensemble, you can go in and you can be like, oh, this is a different kind of feel. What's going on right now? Like, my students are really stressed today. I can feel that. The culture, though, underscores that overarching feeling to be like, okay, it might feel uncomfortable, it might feel great, but at the core of it, there's something that's really grounding us together. You know, I just actually did, ironically, before this conversation, I did an observation of a teacher who has created such an amazingly positive culture within her elementary general classroom. Walking in, these kids are focused, but it's relaxed, but they're really into it. It's an exchange of ideas back and forth. It's an open dialogue. And I would say the same thing. Like, I try to create an environment where it's not just a stand and deliver situation. The culture is inquiry-based. The culture is collaborative. The culture, and this is important, is where kids can call me out and they can push back and challenge me, you know, which I think is something we have the luxury, and sometimes not the luxury, of working with very compliant students because they're very astute, they're very, very high achieving, and they just want to do good by each other and their teachers. But again, I want to create a culture where folks are feel comfortable enough to push back, to bring things up, you know. How do I do that? Oh man, I think that it comes from the way that you enter the classroom. It comes from the way that you interact with students outside of your rehearsal hall. It comes from the way that you plan the first word you're going to say the first day of school. I always map it out. Like I overplan for the very beginning of school, probably more than other teachers and ensemble directors. I'm intentional about like what kind of voice am I going to use and who am I going to who do I want to celebrate or how or what do I want to celebrate with them? Setting the tone is so important, and I do that beginning of every rehearsal. And the kids know. The kids are pretty like. We think that we can hold things in as teachers, but students know whether a teacher's having a good day or if they're having a kind of like an up good day. If they're in a place where the ensemble is going to be rehearsing really hard and they're going to be like really focused, or it's going to be kind of like a more relaxed rehearsal. The kids know that context. So I think we have to be really deliberate, intentional, and also mindful of the way that we come off and the way that we interact with our students. I take every interaction with a student with such a huge amount of responsibility because – I think it was like Haymes Jeannot. There's that philosopher that says like that big quote that says I've come to the frightening realization that as a teacher, you know, I am the weather that the students feel. I am the difference between them feeling humanized or dehumanized, things like that. You know, our tone of voice, the way that we remember things, the way that we follow up with them, those small things, it all adds up. You know, just like we're talking about with these, the repertoire, you know, the small things, it's not like you have to have a hugely regimented plan and all this stuff. It's just about how you connect with students in a human way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Jared, putting on your administrator hat, I mean, you talked about you go into a lot of classrooms, right? Mm-hmm. What are some of the blinking red lights that you can walk? You said you can tell it pretty quickly. What are some of the blinking red lights that you see when perhaps culture is not healthy? Because here's the deal about culture. Some people don't like to talk about it. Every program has a culture. Every business has a culture. Every family has a culture. The question is are you driving it, right? Are you controlling it? Are you driving it? The culture is there, whether we like it or not. So what are some of the things that indicate to you that perhaps the culture is not healthy and perhaps could indicate other educators too?
So just again, I think it's contextual because I think it depends on the community that you're working with and also the cultural backgrounds of the students too and of the teacher. One thing that I recognize a lot, I always wait to see, I do this in my own personal life as well, when a student or a person is given feedback, it could be about their playing or about life things, if you will, but like their playing, singing, things like that, how the students are responding in their facial expressions. Are they maintaining eye contact? Do they look like super crestfallen, disheartened? Do they look like, okay, yeah, I get what you're saying. I can do this. So that's one thing. The way the students respond. I can also see it from the way that the teacher responds. When they hear things that are like, say for instance, an ensemble rehearsal and the teacher hears things that are like out of sorts or the intonation's off or the rhythm's off, how are they not only responding verbally, but like what are those physical things that are like being rebounded and mirrored back to the students, you know? And again, it's that constant synergy between students and teacher, that relationship, the physicality, as well as like, is there a culture of inquiry? Are there questions being asked or are they not being asked? Is this a situation where the students are expected to be compliant and just be told what to do? Or does the teacher invite them in by asking them questions? Is there an opportunity for students to collaborate and to connect with one another, both on a social and also on an academic level by just easily like turn and talk? Like, are they able to voice their own opinions? Or are they saying, is the focus of the rehearsal or the focus of the classroom, it could be general music as well, where they are just like, please don't move, you're not to talk, you can't. Music classes should be like active. It should be like, it can be chaotic and it's okay. I think there's, again, it goes back to we teach the way we taught to some extent. Music should be messy. Music should be engaging. Music should be chaotic, controlled, of course. But it's an overarching feel. Like, yeah, I've gone to classes where other administrators are like, this is completely out of control. I'm like, no, look what these kids are doing over here. They're like voicing opinions and they're active and they're being joyful while at the same time, they're meeting the standards, you know?
Yeah. Love that perspective. Wonderful. Well, Jared, it's so hard to believe, but we are at the 60-minute mark. And so I would love to ask you the question I leave everybody with when we finish up our conversations is if you could go back in time, hop in a time machine, you encounter your young self getting ready to start their first job, what piece of advice would you give your young self?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would go back and say to stay true to like your own, to stay true to your own convictions about what you believe music education to be. I think that was when I came out of college, I felt, yeah, of course I wanted to play advanced literature and really, really work with an ensemble of high caliber and stuff like that. But there was a part of me that was like, I also want to connect with students, but I felt like pressure. There was lots of comparisons even after college. you go to like state festivals or you go to like state conferences or whatnot, and folks are asking, what kind of repertoire are you doing? And why are you doing that repertoire? And how come you're not doing this? And so as a new music educator in the field, it's really easy to get bogged down by like some of the veteran teachers. These people have been teaching for 30, 40 years. They know what they're talking about. Yeah, they do know what they're talking about. But you also, as we come out, sometimes I find our pre-service teachers know a lot more about education sometimes than we do as veteran teachers. So I think I would say stick to your convictions, be open-minded, and know that your impact is going to resonate beyond just a good performance at the end of the day.
Wonderful. Well, Jared, thank you so much. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And in case nobody has told you this today or lately, thank you for the impact that you're making through your students. You are improving your students' lives. You're making better schools, better communities, better citizens. So from all of us at AMRO Music, thank you for the work that you're doing, and your students are lucky to have you.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. My pleasure. My pleasure.
That's Jared Cassidy, K-12 Performing Arts Coordinator for Lexington Public Schools in Lexington, Massachusetts, talking with Nick Averwater on the After Hours Director's Spotlight, which is presented by AMRO Music, a family-owned company since 1921. At AMRO, we work with over 600 schools in 8 states to bring the joy of music to thousands of young musicians, and these partnerships make production of the After Hours podcast possible. Our Director Services Department is ready to work with your school, too. Just email alan@amromusic.com or seth@amromusic.com. The After Hours podcast is produced by Nick Averwater and Joel Hurd in Memphis, Tennessee, and you can hear many more conversations with music educators at amromusic.com/afterhours.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, here are 2 easy and fast ways you can support the After Hours show. First, your 5-star review means a lot, as it helps to boost us in the podcast rankings so that other music educators just like you can find us. Second, if you thought of someone that would enjoy this week's content and episode, hey, please share it with them so that they too can be a part of the After Hours community. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.